a poem by Kabir. Friends, tell me what I am to do about this world I hold to and keep spinning out. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to one thing. So welcome, everyone. Tonight is the first talk in another series of talks. All of these series are under the umbrella of the Four Noble Truths, and the last series were on truth, Noble Truth 1 and 2, and now we're going to take on Truth 3, and then probably the rest of the year, the last 6 months of the year after we finish with these five talks, will be the Eightfold Path. And I might suggest that the Eightfold Path will be a unique perspective of the Eightfold Path, one which has a lay incentive and direction to it. So it's not just what you might have already read out of the many books on that particular subject. And tonight, but it's very important for us to understand this basis of Buddhism. Because if we don't get that, we're really just swimming in the dark. It gives a very unique and a particular direction and vantage point to things that can be extremely helpful, if not essential, in freeing ourselves from the normal and habitual ways that we react and live in the world. Just as a very brief overview of the first two truths, that first truth that highlights the anguish of our lives, the loneliness, the disappointment, the disadvantaged way that we hold ourselves, the way that we are in conflict with in our relationships with all things, not just with people, and that sense of inward conflict that we hold with ourselves as well. And that constant rub of friction between ourselves and the world as we hold ourselves aloof and separate from it burns in terms of pain, in terms of the noble truth of suffering. And then we moved on from just directing that particular point, which is nicely summed up, actually, by Joseph Campbell quote that said, "The cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek." The cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. The cave we most fear to enter is the moving into that pain, to see what that pain is about, to see what is happening at that level of friction, at that rub. And what we ascertain, what we understand when we do go to those areas, is that it's because we keep applying over and over again our own imaginative responses to the world that doesn't really contain alternatives. The world doesn't contain alternatives. It contains one thing. And we keep bringing the alternatives of the mind to that one thing. It's not as if the temperature in this room is any other than what the temperature is. But we bring the alternative of, well, it could be this or that, which the reality does not contain. And it's because of the selection, the card selection from the deck of our memory, and we keep trumping that on top of life. That is why we feel as disadvantaged and as underserved by reality as we feel. And if you look at what that sense of wanting or putting my own agenda upon life, what occurs at that point, where that tendency to want is directed, you'll see that it's often directed towards the pleasurable and away from the unpleasurable aspects. And that was one of the talks I gave on the three aspects of desiring. And the second aspect of desiring is the need for us to continue to exist within the multiplicity of things, to have a place, to have a posture, to have a purpose, to have an intention, to have a sense of ongoing entity-ness, life lived apart from. And we participate and indulge in an ongoing way towards that end. That's one of the ways the desire force asserts itself. And the third way, pleasure and pain, the desire to exist, is seemingly paradoxical, but actually it's the spiritual journey of the longing towards non-existence, the desire, the longing towards the ceasing of all of this conflict, which is bred by our need to exist. And this deep longing for there to be ease or contentment, or however you might speak about that particular liberation. That's the longing for non-existence that is intimated in that third direction of desire. And so if the Buddha left us with those two truths, we would be perhaps a little more insightful and perhaps more sensitive to ourselves, but we wouldn't have a door, an exit, to release this suffering. Because it seems self-perpetuating. I can't figure out on my own what's going on here. And it seems like the best thing I can do is to get involved in therapy. That seems to be my best alternative to a world of pain, or maybe drugs, I don't know. But the Buddha talked about the third noble truth, which is the ending of that. The ending of it. The ending of conflict. The resolution. Phrased differently, complete contentment. Now, I read that poem by Kabir very intentionally because it's quite interesting when the mind has a project, what it likes to do. And there's no better project for the mind to engage itself with than your spiritual development, your spiritual resolution. It loves that one. And you'll keep adding verses to this poem on and on again every time you apply a new strategy towards your salvation. He said, I give up my rage and now I'm greedy. I worked on my greed and now I'm proud. And you can just keep adding verses. But there will always be something that you are in relationship to what you just did, which will keep you existing. And when you begin to see that the mind is a closed system, that there's no exit, that it's like squeezing one part of the tire only to have a bulge in a different part, that there is no way for you to free yourself. That's the great liberating truth. It's like Dante's hell, right? But the message over the entrance to the hell, the inferno, was give up all hope of ever leaving, which was also the third noble truth. Because if we give up the mind's working towards its resolution towards freedom, then we will discover freedom. You see how tricky it is? But we don't know any other way of working this thing than by squeezing the tire again and again and again and adding verses, inevitable verses to this poem. And we get frustrated with that, but it doesn't seem to be convincing until we really get sincere. And the way that sincerity is directed is towards the pain we're causing ourselves as we create additional verses. And when we are willing to look not at the satisfaction of having a new project, which is what keeps us creating, being a composer to more verses, but whether when we're actually willing to look at the pain of creating the verses itself, the pain of pride, the pain of greed, the pain of rage, the pain of another option, the pain of another option, then it will cease. And the pain will cease it, because you will see what you're doing to yourself. It won't cease as long, because we love projects. Even though, and we get somewhere with them. There's no question that skillful means takes you 12 steps forward. It just takes you 12 steps forward in a closed container. And so we have to look very deeply at what the mind's only working can be. The only way it works is either is on the continuum of either attachment, grasping, holding, or detachment, pulling back, pushing away. Now, let's just look at these for a second, because I think they hold a key. If, you know, attachment, initially we think that if we can just abide more consistently with that which we want, if we can just keep it one so that it's continuous, which of course is impossible because it's not continuous, but that's beside the point, and we can stay in close proximity to it, then we'll have our definition of happiness. And so we get attached to the prolongation and continuation of a feeling tone. Now, I don't know if you've ever looked up close to what attachment looks like and how it feels in the body emotionally. But I had an occasion not just to do that, not only to do that in my own practice, which most of us have seen, but also in the early years when I was a monk, I was visiting a saint in India in robes. And I was in Bodh Gaya, the place where the Buddha obtained enlightenment. And there, for those of you who have been in Bodh Gaya, you know the number of beggars that are out there all over. And it was a Christmas Eve, or it might even have been Christmas Day. So I thought I would obtain an orange for each beggar. And I counted the beggars, and there were something like 50 beggars. So I bought 50 oranges. So I had these big things of oranges that I was taking, and they're all lined up along the fence that protected the Bodhi tree where the Buddha was enlightened. And my idea was that I was going to give one orange to each beggar and just go down the line. And so I started holding one of the bags up, and I gave the first orange to the first beggar, and all 50 beggars, or however many there were, on down the line saw me do that, and they all came running at me, ripping the bag open, and the oranges, of course, tumbling everywhere, some running away with four or five oranges, and others not getting any. But I saw their faces. I saw their faces. I still see their faces. Now, that's the face of survival. I'm not in any way judging them. I probably would have done the same. But you see what's driving that greed factor, the need to exist. And I just embedded in my mind are the faces of the beggars as they were swarming around me, and with that greed intention and ripping at the bags, and you know, all of my fairness issues, and how, you know, how I was going to do this with methodically and righteously, and all that just went to the... You see that one time in a human being. If you see that up close and personal, you know, we can get a feeling for it in market economy all the time. It's in the backdrop. But when you see it personified, manifesting as a state, and you see it in yourself, so that you don't hold the state that you see the person in different from what you also have in yourself, then you get on the task of addressing this issue. So the mind moves towards that attachment, and it also moves or swings in its pendulum form towards when it sees, my God, look how awful this feeling of attachment is. There, that sense of aversion or sense of repulsiveness can swing you back towards detachment. That's the mind trying to make its own fix, trying to recover its own sanity within itself, trying to put out one storm only to raise an additional fervor through its detachment. So what does detachment look like? Well, because we have to be very careful here. Well, detachment in its own manifestation is as ugly as greed, because it's cold-hearted. It's distant, aloof, non-caring. It's I have an example of that when I was in hospice care. A couple that we were serving, the husband was dying of cancer and was very close to death, and the wife suddenly developed a pain on her own, and she went to the hospital only to discover that she had end-stage lymphoma as her husband was dying. So I, because I was involved with the family through her husband's death, dying, I went to the hospital to visit her. And when I sat down with her, the woman I had known prior to her diagnosis wasn't there. She had buried herself into some deep cave of consciousness. And I could just see that she was, the eyes, it was looking into a cave and seeing two eyes stare back at you like tiger eyes or something that was just cold and unapproachable. And it threw me. And I didn't know how to touch her or how to reach her. And I said, what is it? And I knew, though, that her heart, she had a good heart because I had spoken with her before. And I knew that somehow there needed to be a re-engagement in her heart. And I said, I sat there. And I said rather spontaneously, I said, what is it that you even live for now? Now you know you're going to die and your husband's going to die. And she said, only two things, she said. I live now for my daughter and for my own spiritual growth. And I said, you know, Jane, though no one would have ever wished this upon you, this situation, it has driven you to seeing the sort of the fundamental raw purpose of life. That is love and growth. And I don't know if there had been any other situation that you could have been set up in life that would have showed it to you with such drama as it's showing to you now. And as sometimes these stories have happy endings and sometimes they don't, but she was able to turn back into the love of her daughter and redirect it and to come out of that cave. The point, though, is that we can go into that cave when we see the horrors of what we face in our meditation, when we look into the old mirror of our own mind and see what we see. It can be so discouraging that it sends us the other way into the cutoffness. I can't tell you how many times I've had a hospice worker, nurse, or social worker, or someone say to me, this job would be so much easier if I just could learn not to care. And it would, because that's where they saw themselves vulnerable. Although I saw that as the only link between their own salvation is the caring. We can never give that up. We are drawn to care more, not to care less. And if you ever find yourself going the other way in that, you know that you're moving adharmically against the Dharma. In all aspects of your life, because these forms of these swings of attachment and detachment are not just a whitewash for everything, but happen individually in individual situations in the immediacy of the presentation. And then there is another, there is non-attachment. Non-attachment. Non-attachment is life meeting itself with no boundaries, with no protections and no conditionality. I want to tell you, the last 10 days, which is the reason I wasn't here, my wife and I were on vacation in the Yucatan, one of the only vacations we've taken in almost 20 years together. And we did a lot of things, very fun things. One of the things that I really wanted to do, one of the experiences I wanted to have was I wanted to swim with the dolphins. So we went out to a place that had that opportunity. But when I saw what was happening, I saw that it was, the way that the humans and the dolphins were meeting were along performance. I mean, the dolphins were performing. They weren't, there was no real genuineness in the meeting. They were pushing the people, doing dolphin things. And I didn't want any part of that. I didn't want any part of that because it was totally not the way I wanted to meet a dolphin. But I had a deep urge in me to meet a dolphin. And so, the problem was that there was a wall between me and the pond, the huge pond where all the dolphins were, and there were security guards. Well, twice I leapt over the wall because I wasn't going to stop. I wanted to meet the dolphins. And they threw me out with increasing anger. But I still wasn't deterred. I waited till the guy went up there, and all the dolphins were peopled out. They didn't want anything to do with people. Their whole day was peopled. But there was one little dolphin that just was kind of flirting at about 20 feet off the edge. And I waited till the security guard, although he kept looking back at me, was up there, and I leaped over the wall, and I just reached my hand down in the water, and the dolphin came right up to it. And there was a meeting there. I think it was a she, looked me right in the eye, and I just met it. And there's a Westerner behind the wall looking at me. He says, "That's the damnedest thing I've ever seen. That's the damnedest thing I've ever seen." I thought so too. And then I leaped over the wall just as the security guard was and ran to my van, and we whisked away. So it had a happy ending. But that meeting, that transcendence, it was a meeting in transcendence. I don't know, I've met a moose that way one time, but that's a different story. When species meet species outside of themselves, do you know what I mean? That's why I didn't want to meet it on a performance. But when life meets itself, just meeting itself in different forms, different expressions, there's a transcendence there. And I feel as if there was a complete understanding in that moment between that dolphin and I, as there was between the moose and I many years earlier. And there are many occasions, I love that across species transcendence, because it's not about species. It's not about the outfit we wear. It's not about this closure we're in. It has something far beyond that, And we have placed ourselves outside of the animal realm in the way that we behold animals. Each animal is a complete being in itself. It's a complete being. It's not a lesser being or part of a being. And to start involving ourselves with that kind of sensitivity allows the sense of interconnection and that transcendence. Release, you see, it's about release. The mind, though, when it thinks of release, it does it conditionally. It tries to set boundaries, or it sets options in its need to release. It's conditional release. It's a mental escape. It tries to escape itself mentally. But it's the mentalness of which we're escaping from. You can't use the very thing that causes the problem to end the problem. What ends the problem? Awareness. Awareness is the end of the problem. Awareness. And awareness, the byproduct of awareness, the relationship that awareness has with something, what happens just in the course of awareness, the byproduct of it, is understanding, wisdom. That wisdom informs the ego. And the ego then releases itself. And that's how the practice works. We have to be careful, though, that we don't use the mind, because the mind is enormously subtle in how it will propose its own end, how it will strategize its own demise. It's like it hears words like openness, and it says, okay, well, I know what openness is. I know what openness is. It's acceptance. So I'll go around accepting people, or I'll be friendly, or I don't know. I mean, it figures out a mental strategy for every word it ever hears, because it can only think in terms of those strategies, and then applies those mental words to whatever the heart is trying to show that doesn't have word connotation at all. And so acceptance becomes resignation, right? So non-attachment becomes, I'm resigned to this, you know. So instead of it being alivening, it's a deadening quality. Resignation, you can feel it. You can feel the dead weight of resignation. Well, you've given up hope. Now can you give up hope and be alive? You see, this whole thing is about letting go, and really the title of tonight's talk is The Liberation from Self-Belief, Letting Go, Stage 1. It's letting go. And the reason I say that is that letting go is an evolution for most of us. We let go at first conditionally because that's all we know. We let go mentally. We let go in terms of a mental way that we work it. Another vacation story. We're coming back from vacation to the airport, and I'd heard that Bush was also in Cancun and arrived the day before, and I was, he can't leave me alone. I was listening. I was into that spin, right? So we get to the airport, and what's out on the tarmac but Air Force One? So it was like, and no planes could land when Air Force One is something, you can't land, nothing can take off, nothing can land. And our plane flight from Cancun to Denver was very closely timed because I had a connecting flight in Denver to get home here in Seattle. And we sat there for 3 hours while his plane didn't take off. And our plane, which was trying to land but couldn't, had to go back into some Mexican town and refuel and come back. So it was like 3 hours before we could take off. Of course, we missed the connecting flight in Denver. And I was going through my political reaction. There was no letting go. It was, okay, so I said, I was doing my Dharma talk to myself. Okay, you know, don't get angry at him. just release the, you know, I was trying to talk myself into letting go and having very little success being able to do that. And then it just kind of all, I don't know, the dam broke. Not that I went into a rage. It went the other way. I just, to hell with it, you know. This man is not going to control my life in Mexico. He does enough of that in the U.S. And that's it. That's it. This is going to be, you know, so here we are at the airport. All right, 3 hours, missed flight, and that's it. That's it. Now, the letting go with a complete dropping. It wasn't a resignation. Damn. Well, I might as well get you. It wasn't that. That's a mental configuration, a mental attempt. You know what it's like to drop something? You know what it's like to be completely unburdened? Most of us have had a relative sense of that, quite likely. Like if you have a project that's been wearing on you and stressful, or you have, you know, a talk to give, or some, you know, some difficult or stressful situation you're going through, and then you come out the other side of that and the court case is resolved or the talk is given, or there's this feeling of being light. The reason that we appreciate that feeling so much is because there's been a release. The release has been conditional, and it's only known because of how burdened I was before. That's how you know yourself to have, it's a relative release, because you only know the lightness because of you remember the burden. And so the sense of relative release is something that most of us, but we don't know the other. We don't know the absolute release because you can't know it. Because it's the end of comparison. It doesn't have a counter thing and say, God, this feels really good. I remember when I was feeling. It doesn't have that kind of judgmental weight. It's just, but most of us, everyone really, and perhaps many times in your life, will have situations where you're just being present. You're not having egoically to manifest anything. There's just a sense of presence and a sense of complete ease within that presence. And there's no tension whatsoever. And you come out of that and there's no remembering of it because it was a natural state. You don't say, you know, you don't look at it in comparison to another moment. And so then it's confiscated by the egoic. So when I had a great time gardening or whatever I was doing, and now on to other things, you see. But that's those moments, those genuine moments where the heart has no intention, no purpose, no everything. Is the aliveness of everything is in bloom. Life meeting life. The hand of life meeting the flower of life. Those moments. That's what letting go. That's what release is. How's that done? Did you do that? Did you decide that when you went into your flower garden or wherever you might have been, did you decide to have that moment? The other one, the relative release, that probably was all of your production. Working hard, getting in, finishing the talk, and feeling relaxed because of the tension you carried. That relative burden. But the true release is not of your doing. It's not of your doing, but you can see how close it is to us. How you can touch it. If it's there and manifest many times in our life, how it must be immediately accessible. Do not let us forget that. Just because we keep working it mentally, it's not accessible. Because we keep trying to... You see, this thing has to shift energetically. You just give it up. It's not going to work itself out here in the upper 6 inches of your body. It's just not going to work itself out there. You're not going to free yourself. You've done enough damage up there. It's disabled. You've whacked it like a computer. You've just beaten with a hammer. One of you. And in that moment, there's no self-referencing. You see. Liberation from self-belief. Liberation from self-belief. That's it. There's nothing secret. There's no hole you have to bore into some mystical mountain. There's no special food. that you just, and then you join life. You don't give it up. You just understand that it's been an artificial boundary. It's been artificially induced. This sense of me here and everyone else there is artificially determined. When we look at it, we have to look at it, most of it, that's the Buddhist way. When you observe that boundary, it doesn't show itself to be real. And if you're willing to release, to let go of the need for its formation, which is a big if, because most of us are afraid of the void that we would discover in that release. We think that there's something awful to be felt on the other side of releasing our tension. So we maintain our tension in order not to feel what we fear must be there if we ever did release. And so we're never willing to release because our fear keeps us in check. And so we never discover what's so easily acceptable. Listen to the words I'm using. I'm not suggesting, 20 years here. I'm not suggesting burdensome. This is accessible, people. If we don't believe that, then let's clear the room. If you don't know that it's as close to you as the nose on your face, closer. And if that doesn't lead to you spinning and pondering, you see, that's the wrong way. You can't figure this thing out. You can just drop it. But we have to know so that we will get into the Eightfold Path as a means. But that should never discourage us from the understanding that it's always accessible. So we'll get into that. But I want you to carry away that sense of it being the availability. See, but letting go, what do we let go of? We let go of ourselves. We think we have to let go of what we're holding on to. You know, the anger we have or what. But what makes it so difficult to let go of the anger or the jealousy or the envy or the rage or the whatever it is that we're trying to push away or detach ourselves from is because we are defined by it. It defines who we are to have it. And so to let go, we're not about to let go of ourselves. We'll easily want to let go of the anger, but not the righteousness of the person who's angry, because that's right. I'll let go of this part, but I want to keep the other. I want to keep the indignation. I want to keep my stance, my posture. I want to keep my forbearance. I want to keep my pride. And so we see that these things are mutually defined. That, you see, letting go is a terrible phrase. I don't know how that ever got, because it always feels to me like there's something in your hand, you know, and it's like gum. Yeah. Because we work it the wrong way. It's here. That's where we let go. We let go. And the first thing you find is that there's often an emotional tone that resists letting go. There's grief or there's fear in letting go. And so the emotional tone binds us to the need to grip and hold on. So if we're not able just to drop things, which few of us are, depends on what it is, to be honest, then we have to bring attention to the emotional component. Because the emotional component is where we have consolidated around ourselves and identified so strongly with that emotional tone that that prevents our sense of release, because that's where we're all stuck, we're all configured, our stance, our postures around that emotional tone. But you look at it, it's just an emotion with just a storyline passing through. And as we begin to work our way with that, it becomes very easy. It's like, why do I have to keep telling myself this? So what? What am I doing? You know what I'm doing? I'm joining. I'm not letting go of anything. I'm letting go of what it is that's keeping me distant from, that's keeping me separate, that's keeping me positioned so that I'm never joined. Why don't I join? Why don't I join? You see, what you wanted from it, what you wanted out of it, with it, who you were in relationship to it, your stake in it, all of those things. I was doing a talk one time and I was talking about compassion. Compassion is open-ended. It doesn't have boundaries. And of course, whenever you make that statement, somebody in the crowd is going to say, be compassionate to Hitler. How can you do that? Compassionate to Genghis. They're going to try to disprove the equation of absolute. Doesn't sit well. I'm not going to be compassionate to Hitler. Everybody else. So that I inevitably get that. Because there's nothing the mind likes to do than disprove. And it's got somebody here. Hitler? Now let me listen to this. Yes. Because the heart demands it. Yes, Hitler. We can leave nothing out. If we leave a molecule out, that's sufficient to create the despair and the distance. Letting go is surrender. And surrender is the act of releasing our separation. Surrender, letting go, is the act of releasing separation. That's what it is. Because it's through our attachments and aversions that we create the distance we have between ourselves and everything. And to release the need for something, to release the need to object, to opinionate, to disdain, brings you together. Because that's the only thing that has ever separated us. And when you see that, then you use separation as food for your spiritual growth. In Christianity, they talk about let go, let God. And I think that's a beautiful way to represent an ongoing relationship. Let go, let God. To back away from the need to be stubborn. And when you let go, let God, in the Christian sense of that, you're not forcing yourself into the forefront of the picture. It's not about one's own empowerment there. And that, of course, takes enormous faith. And in faith in Christianity is different than faith in Buddhism. And in Buddhism, we talk about resting in awareness. Awareness. Let awareness come forth. Let awareness come forth. Let the world take care of itself. Because the whole world wakes up when we take a back seat. You can be in the back seat, watch the whole world pass, or you can be driving frantically and never see a thing. Awareness. And in practice, more and more, allowing awareness just to have its own... It delights. It's delightful. Just relaxing and letting awareness speak for itself. Show it. Show us what? Show it itself. And sometimes the mind gets lost. No problem. It's just... the configuration of things, and there's a lot to be learned when the mind does get lost. So don't begrudge it. And it'll come back in again, because it has to, because the world is awake. And if we're not constantly focusing intentionally upon our own needs and the tension, it'll wake up on its own. We just have to be in the right direction. We have to know the right direction to wake it up, to wake ourselves up into it. I'm just trying to set us up now so that we have the right spiritual orientation. So much pain from the wrong orientation. And you waste your life thinking you're getting somewhere spiritually. And you're just adding to your karmic base. Just like at the airport with W. I mean, that's just, he and I'll come around again somewhere, and then hell, you can just. Meditation. So move letting go into your meditation. Begin to orient your meditation. And letting go, I think Stephen Levine mentioned it, and it's a good way to look at it, is not doing anything to the object. It's letting the object be. So last thing you want to do is let something be. Because it's completely disempowering to let something be on its own merit. It gives us no sense of purpose. I have purpose when I have to do something to that. I have no purpose at all in letting it be. So I'm robbed of my own sense of strength. And that's where it should take us. It should feel like the oil draining out of your car. We have to move out of ourselves. And see what's left when the last drop of the oil departs the oil pan. What does that feel like? What's there then? What's there now? That's the question I want to leave us all with. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? Start by doing nothing to your mind. Just leaving it alone. Whatever it's doing, whatever it's expressing, it's fine. Giving it a huge berth, a huge wingspan. What difference does it make? What possible difference does it make what it's doing? Go look and see if you're in any of that. See, search yourself through that labyrinth of activity. See if you're anywhere in there. If you are, for God's sakes, do something to save yourself. But if you're not, what is there to do? Let your practice move more and more into this rest, this letting go, this letting be. Any questions or comments that anyone might have? Yes. Yes.
What would caring very deeply look like towards another where there's non-attachment?
What would caring look like when you care deeply for another with non-attachment? It would look like pure listening. It would look like that there was a genuine meeting, not of opinions, but of presence. It would look like a deconstruction, not a construction. Its face would have the face of affection, because that's what happens when we deconstruct. It's not an artificial affection that we motivate ourselves to feel a certain way, because that's just more pretension. It's the elimination of the constructs, the boundaries, that is the genuine meeting, not the orientation or preparation for a meeting. So in my way of looking at it, it is dropping one's opinions about about the other, and all of the discordant comments that the mind continually makes in relationship to another as you're listening or being with that person, the historical storyline that one has had, the release of all that, and then there's a genuine meeting, like the first time you met. Like when you had no ideas about that person, when there was a true innocence in that first interaction. Now, is that possible? It is not possible to forget your history. It's only possible not to invest in the history, not to forget the history. You're going to know what this person did. All that's going to be there. But the investment in it comes through the identification of you needing it for some sense of protection for your relationship with this person. And that's just the lack of faith and confidence that we have in awareness. Awareness doesn't lose its discerning power. It doesn't lose its ability to draw from memory when it's needed. But we don't have to keep saying, I remember this, I remember this, I remember that, in order for that to come forth in the meeting, if it's necessary for that to happen. But then it doesn't come forth when it's not. And when it doesn't come forth, which means we're not investing in the memory of what this person is to me, then there can be a genuine meeting in the listening. Does that make sense to you? Yes, thank you for the question. I'm softer tonight, which is very interesting. It's good to go on vacation. I'm learning the... Maybe it won't be 20 years the next time. Others. Anyone else? Yes.
Could you just talk a little bit more about the last thing you said about leaving yourself alone when you sit?
Yes. I talk a little bit more about leaving yourself alone when you sit. Leaving yourself alone when you sit. Leaving yourself alone when you're awake. Leaving yourself alone in movement and active. You know, we're the commentator, the judger, the checker, the person who is, you know, it's like, there she goes again. You're doing the same thing you've done this whole life. How can you do that? You know, it's like a commentary on a football game or something. Good run there. You fumbled that one. That one. You know, that sensor. Why do we need that? Why do we need continuous commentary? What is it that that's offering us? You see, that's what... Okay, I don't know now. What is it? What is that offering us? What is it offering that's useful? It's fear-based, because I'm afraid of what this person is thinking about me, so I have a commentator that kind of corrects internally rather than... So because I don't trust myself to relax with myself and to be authentic, because I haven't ever practiced that. I've practiced changing myself to accommodate what other people need. And so this commentator begins to build in strength and volume. I don't have that anymore. And I'm not saying that in any kind of... It just falls away naturally in one's... It just is, because you just... It doesn't fall away from... It falls away from non-use. It falls away because it does... You see that it doesn't... Kucinich, the presidential candidate, said something in an interview. He said, "It's none of my business what other people think of me." That's why it falls away. It's not a non-care. I don't care what anybody thinks of me. It's not that. It's just none of my business what you think of me. And therefore, I'm free to be natural. Because it's not, I don't really, it's none of my business what you're thinking of me. And it has no bearing on me. That's why it falls away. And when it falls away like rain off a roof. And it gets quieter and quieter and quieter and shrivels up. And you begin to leave yourself more and more alone. And as we begin to move into the pockets of our pain and see that where we have held ourselves, where we have grouped around that pain, how we have coalesced around that pain in terms of our identity, when we look into the pain, that identity and the storyline begins to dissipate, begins just to not, it doesn't group anymore, it just floats away, then the pain floats away as well. And it's through the pain that we have been as hard on ourselves. Because of the pain, we've been as hard on ourselves as we are. And as the pain, pockets of pain, dissipate, so does the self-bickering, which is caused by the pain. The quote from Joseph Campbell, "The cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek." Yes.
I believe that it doesn't matter what other people think of me, truly. But I do believe that it matters what somebody does to me. Can you comment on that?
He doesn't believe that it matters what people think of him, but he does believe it matters what people do to him. Is that right? Well, I mean, if they're going to cause you like physical harm, well, of course. But what do you need an inward commentator to know when somebody's coming at you with a club? Right? You see, we downplay what awareness, the discernment quality of awareness. Awareness shows everything. In fact, it shows much more. Before, when you're just on your commentator, when you're only listening to that and not in the relationship, then you miss the cues of the abuse because of your own abuse. You miss the cues. But when you're clear about your love for yourself and somebody violates or moves into a direction that's counter to that love that you have for yourself, it's so immediately obvious. And you don't hang around that person. Why would I want to do that? Why would I want to have that kind of onslaught? So it takes care of itself and you move out of harm's way. And you don't say you're deserving of the harm because that's just inward pain that's expressing itself in that direction. And you take care of yourself and you look after yourself and you care about yourself. And that itself puts you out of harm's way. So it's self-fulfilling. This awareness is self-acknowledging, self-fulfilling, and self-discerning. I mean, I don't go down to seedy parts of town because what do I care what people think of me? Why would I do that? I mean, it doesn't make sense to you and it doesn't make sense to me. I don't lose that making sense because I'm not constantly commentating upon, I don't know, you see? Just trust it. Trust it. Give it a go. You know, it's like you don't have anything to lose anymore. You got $10,000 and you need $20,000 to make your life work. So put it all on red. Spend a dial. If it goes black, that's it. You didn't have enough money anyway. But now you either win it or you don't. So that's what it is. So you know what? Put it all on red. Put it all on awareness. Say, he may be, I don't believe, I can't tell you the number of people who come through the house in interviews and saying, you know what, this thing you said about this or that, this most current one was joy. So I was aware and there was joy. I saw that joy and awareness were the same thing. And I thought, I don't know how many times I've said that in my discourses, but it didn't mean anything to that person until they saw it, until they found it. You see, I'm just pointing. I'm a police officer, traffic directing, and I'm trying to push you down the darkest avenue that you could possibly think you'd ever want to go down. You want to stay in the main street with lights and flashes and, you know, and I'm going, and you start going down and you start working. And you go, wow. And that takes care of the next step and the next step and the next step. And you start really moving. Okay. Yes.
Ironically, I was just trying to think of that commentator and trying to think of examples of you ever did anything helpful.
Yes. See if it, okay, good. This person says he's trying to look at the commentator and see if it's ever done anything helpful. That's a beautiful question. It's okay, check it out. See if it's ever done anything helpful for you. If it hasn't just kept you distant. But helpful means, has it ever allowed you to join? Not that it hasn't accurately predicted something that might happen to you, but that was awareness that showed you that. You don't need a commentator. You don't need somebody talking in your head for awareness to show you. When you see something, the information is there. You don't have to then speak about it to yourself, you see? It's like looking through a rearview mirror trying to drive your car and talking all the time about what you've just seen. Wow, that was a great bush I just went by. And that was wow, look at that, I just passed a 1947. It's like, you don't do that when you drive. You got to get... I don't know if this is making any sense. Let the heart come out. That's all. I look for different ways to encourage you out of your shell. Okay, so let your heart come out. Come on. Caring. Come on. It's like E.T. got drawn out of the cave through M&Ms. Here's an M&M. Oh. Yes. Yes.
I kind of wanted to just ask you something about more about that, because I think, you know, like the poem with the greed or whatever, like I let go of this and then I let go of that and then I turn around and I walk off like, oh,
right.
Good thing I let go of that, and it's like stuck to my foot and I'm like, no,
right.
So on there, and trying to, like one good friend told me, they said, well, you can't hate yourself into being a better person.
That's right.
Because I know that there's a part of me that just gets so fed up.
That's right.
With the stickiness of
That's right.
all of that.
That's right. And that will the stickiness, Lizette, will last forever. It will last forever. You know, you it's, you know, a bear rabbit and a tar baby. You can't pull yourself out of it. So you hit it with the other hand and you're stuck in it with that. So you kick it with your knee and your knee's stuck. And then you're just all tar and everything you touch sticks. And you think you're working towards your salvation. But the salvation is the stuckness. That is the sense of thinking that you're working towards your salvation is where you're stuck. That's what it means to be stuck. That you're going somewhere, that you're progressing, because that's how the mind frames itself. It's a wonderful organism. It really is. It's an amazing organism. It has to dualize, that's a word, create separation in order for it to navigate. So it has, you know, in order to get out of the way of harm's way, in order to do all the things that we have to do functionally in the world, this is an important organism. But it isn't the organism of life. The organism of life is the heart, the unification. And so when you try to work out your salvation through the organism that has certain functionality but is dysfunctional in relationship to ever joining anything, because that's not its point, its purpose isn't that, then you realize that your spiritual life will be defunct if you move it in that direction. Would die. But it seems so convincing because we've done so much through the mind door that we've accomplished, and why can't this just be another task that we've set ourselves? Okay, so that's enough for tonight. Thank you all very much. Okay.